Welcome back to another episode of Passive Income Pilots. My name is Ryan Gibson. Tate is not feeling very well today, so it'll just be me today on the show. But we've got a great show today with Kyle Williams, who is going to talk about 1031 exchange information as we get into it. We also are going to have a couple of callers into the show today. We're going to welcome a couple of people on. But before we get started, I wanted to give some kind of overview of what's happening right now in the real estate industry. And one of the things that I really wanted to focus on is this new tax change that's going through. It went through the House and it's now, I believe, going through the Senate and potentially could be on the new president's desk, whoever that might be in November, which is talking about the changes that is happening to bonus depreciation. And that's as prior to the 2017 tax code change, we got this thing called bonus depreciation, which gave you 100% deduction of all your short-term lives. When you buy a property, you do a cost segregation study. We talked about that on episode 14 and we on another episode previously with Yona Weiss, who went deep into cost segs. If you missed that episode, you can go back to, and you can listen to all about cost segregation studies. We're not going to talk about that today, but for those that listened or understand what the cost seg is, it gives you all these short-term lives in either 5 or 15-year buckets. And when bonus depreciation came around, it allowed you to take 100% of that 5 and 15 year life and deduct it in the first year. Well, that tax code change also had a sunset date. So it sunsets in completely in 2026. But the new tax code that's going through the industry right now will actually restore it back to 100% bonus depreciation, meaning you can take more tax breaks on real estate activity. And I had a chance to talk to a cost segregation expert at a conference this weekend in Orlando, and he was thinking that it might come down to whoever gets elected. That'll be the first thing that they sign into order. And that might be coming in 2024, or maybe late 2024, which would allow you to 100% bonus depreciate anything you buy in 2024, potentially. Now, this is all speculative, but fun conversation. If you're thinking about buying real estate this year, it might come with 100% bonus depreciation, which is really neat. But anyway, I'm here today. I've got a special guest, Kyle, who's actually in our studio in Seattle, Washington today with me. Kyle, welcome to the show. So before we get talking about why we brought you to the show, we just launched a new feature on our website. So if you go to our website, passiveincomepilots.com, and you can actually find a place where you can be on the show. And so you press a button and it gives you some talking points and what to say. We want to hear from you. We want to hear from our listeners. Where do you fly? What seat are you in? How long have you been at your airline? If you don't want to share that information, you don't have to. But if you want to ask a question on the show, you can do that now on our website. And you can just hit record right from your phone and literally record right into your phone what your question is. We're going to go ahead and go to our first call-in who's got a question. Steve, welcome to Passive Income Pilots. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, Ryan and Tate. This is Steve. I love your podcast and thanks for having me on. So I'm a partner at a law firm that pays me with a K-1. I recently invested in a real estate syndication that also issues a K-1, but with depreciation each year. My question is this: will the depreciation from the syndication investment offset the income that I receive from my law firm's K-1? Thanks again, guys. I've learned a ton from your show and really appreciate it.
Yeah, so Steve, that's a fantastic question, and one I'm sure that many of our listeners can relate to. You know, the interplay between different sources of income and how they might affect your tax situation, you know, are quite complex. And we covered this on episode 14 as well, when we talked about the three different types of income somebody can earn. You have income that's passive, portfolio income, and then you have income that's taxed as active income, which is usually coming from your W-2. In this instance, Steve has a interesting question about his law firm income that generates a K-1 because it's part of a partnership. And Steve invested in one of our syndications that has a K-1 this year, and it comes with a substantial loss in year one because of bonus depreciation. And he's wondering, hey, can that offset some of my partnership income from his law firm activities? In order to get an answer, because again, we don't give any tax, legal, or professional or investment advice on the show. This is just friendly conversation. We try to bring on some of the best guests to give that advice. So today, what we did was we actually reached out to Toby Mathis from Anderson Advisors, who's a seasoned law expert and tax and legal professional, and is a familiar voice to our listeners as we've had him on our show a couple of times. But Toby has actually called in and given us the answer. So Toby, go ahead.
Yeah. So when you receive a K-1 from any business activity, that's the pass-through of that income or loss onto your return. And so when you see a K-1 coming from an active business like a law firm, that's going to be active ordinary income. When you receive a K-1 from a syndication, then that's going to be real estate income, which is generally going to be passive unless you fall in one of two categories. First category is an active participant where you're making less than $100,000 adjusted gross income every year, and you can write off up to $25,000. I seriously doubt an accredited investor is ever going to qualify for that. So we're going to have to look at number two, which would be a real estate professional. If you're a real estate professional, it means that you work in a real estate trader business. There's like 10 of them, everything from being a broker to managing property, construction, development, et cetera. And if you do more than 750 hours and it's more than 50% of your time, you could qualify as a real estate professional. And then prong two is you have to materially participate on your investment activities. So this is going to get kind of weird. When you're dealing with a syndication, it means you're probably going to have to do at least 500 hours between you and a spouse of actual involvement in those real estate activities. And we're going to have to make an aggregation election to couple them all together. So I hate to be long-winded on this, but it means unless you're a real estate professional, there's a good chance that 99% chance, let's just say that you're not going to be able to use the loss from the K-1 from your investment against your income that's coming from your law firm.
So thanks, Toby, for that very detailed answer. It really highlights the importance of really understanding the nuances of your investment and how they interact with your overall tax situation. And it's conversations like these that really can make a big difference in the way that you think about approaching and asking the right questions of your tax and legal professionals. So anyway, it was exciting to hear Toby's voice and have him back onto the show. We actually have him planned for an April episode where we're actually going to go through the 10 top tax deductions of real estate or of airline pilots. We're actually going to go through and say, what are the 10 tax tips for airline pilots specifically? So we've prepared that show for you. So we really look forward to that episode airing and having Toby back on the show again. Today, again, if you want to go to passiveincomepilots.com and give your questions, we can have you come on to the show. And we love to hear from our listeners and we love to hear people give our praise, and it's really encouraging to keep this going. So anyway, back to our guest today, Kyle Williams. He's the Senior Vice President at Velocity 1031, and he's a maestro in the field with over a decade of experience steering investors through the tax complex airspace, as they say, of real estate investments. And fasten your seatbelts, everybody. It's going to be a fun ride talking about 1031 exchanges today. Kyle, can you just give us a quick background on your investing experience specifically as it relates to 1031 exchanges?
Yeah. So I actually got out of college. I went into finance and worked on a trading desk for a bond firm that did a lot of structured investments, bonds, interest rate stuff. So my background was really interest rates. We did some private placements, REITs and everything, but that's my background.
Yeah. So really the thing that I'd like to just start really high level before we start getting into like tax code and 1031 and all these confusing things. Can you just boil down quickly in real layman's terms, how does a 1031 exchange work?
Yeah, 1031 exchange is a very unique part of the tax code. It allows an investor to sell an investment property and use all the equity, not just the after-tax equity, all the equity to reinvest in something. Our job is a qualified intermediary.
Hold on one second. I want to pick at that. Don't go deep. So basically what you're saying is that if I have a rental property and I sell it, I can defer all of the taxes that I would have to pay if I buy another property. And we'll get into the details as the show goes. But the bottom line up front here is if you're holding real property, real estate as an investment vehicle, now this can't be like your primary residence or things like that. But if you're holding real property that you're renting out, you basically, when you sell it, you don't have to pay the gain. You can actually tax defer it into something else. Is that, did I have that right?
That's absolutely right. And it doesn't even have to be rented out. It could be land.
Oh, wow.
Land is technically investment property. And so I know that there's a lot of pilots with land too, that they can actually exchange that. And a lot of landowners have the same story. Oh, I bought land years ago. It's gone up, everything else. But I'm not really income from it. I'm not getting the tax benefit of depreciation. They can sell that, defer all the taxes, and invest in like a duplex, self-storage, something like that. It's where they get income. They get the tax benefit of depreciation. So there's a lot of cool stuff you can do.
Yeah. And we're going to go through step by step how to actually do this. And we're going to talk about the show. But just the key takeaway is if you're a pilot out there or a listener who has property that you're thinking about selling, what you really should be doing is thinking about calling Kyle.
Yep, absolutely. Today,
because you need to start this process before the property actually sells, correct?
So we set it up once the client gets under contract. It's all got to be set up in advance of closing, because if you close and the exchange is not, the 1031 exchange is not set up, then you can't 1031 exchange. You can't retroactively set it up. So as Ryan mentioned, once you're under contract, yeah, let us know. If you have questions before then, okay, this is what I'm thinking about. Does this make sense? Absolutely. Give me a call. Shoot me an email.
Yeah. And I would even say as a good pre-flight planner, like I appreciate wanting to talk to you like when you're under contract, but you know, I would imagine that your firm helps people. If even if you're thinking about selling the property, it might be appropriate if you're going to move forward with a transaction. It might be okay to just to contact, just to touch base and make sure that, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, because you know things happen very quickly and there's some timelines surrounding this investment that kind of restrict you in what you can do, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. Definitely encourage people, talk to me sooner rather than later. Because as I mentioned, once you close, it's too late to set up the exchange. But even if you're thinking about, you probably have questions on what's this like kind thing I've heard about? How long am I going to have to find property? All that stuff you should be calling me about well in advance of selling your
property. That's great. Okay, so let's just dive into what we would consider the timelines for invest. So let's go through some of the mechanics of that. Okay, let's just say I call you, you answer all my questions, and then I actually put my property under contract. When does the clock start ticking for the 1031 exchange?
After you close on your sale, closing on the sale is day zero. After you close, you have 45 days to identify a new property to purchase. Well, what does that mean? You have to let us know, the 1031 company, the qualified intermediary, what you're going to purchase. It's got to be in writing. You've got to be under contract. But ultimately, you have 180 days to close on what you've identified.
Okay, so I've always wondered this. 45 days to identify a property. And so I'm using your services to commensurate the transaction. What do I have to prove? Okay, so let's say I find house A I'm selling and house B I identify. What do I have to do to prove that I've identified that as my replacement property?
You have to be under contract or you have to let us know in writing. It's got to be a legal description or address of the property. Can't say rental in Duluth, Minnesota. It's got to be 123 Main Street, Duluth, Minnesota.
Gotcha. And a lot of listeners in Duluth, good reference there. Okay, so it's a pilot. It's a place where a lot of pilots, I think there's a lot of pilots that flew from Northwest and things like that.
It's like the Gig Harbor.
Yeah, we call Gig Harbor Peachtree City West. Okay. So Peachtree City is where a lot of Delta pilots live in Georgia. Gig Harbor is just the West Coast version of that. So anyway, so that aside, so you're telling me that if we identify property, so let's just say I don't have it under contract. I can just say, hey, that house that's listed on the MLS, I'm thinking about putting a bid on it and I'm thinking about that being my replacement property. So long as it has a real property address, I'm good, right?
Absolutely. Okay. It doesn't even have to be for sale. That being said, no matter where you're at in the country right now, whether you're in Peachtree City, whether you're in Seattle, it doesn't matter where, real estate moves quickly. So you want to be under contract within the 45-day ID period if you can. You just don't technically.
Is there a limit on how many properties I can identify without driving you completely crazy?
Yeah, no. There's, so most people will use what's called the three property rule. You can identify up to three properties, any value to purchase. If you wanted to identify more than three, let's say that you wanted to buy four or five rentals, say, you could do that under the 200% rule, meaning you can identify any number of properties totaling no more than 200%. So you sell for 800,000, you can identify any properties totaling up to the last rule. It's called 95% exception. I call it the all or none rule. If you wanted to identify the entire city of Duluth, Minnesota, you can do that. But the caveat is that you have to close on 95% of the value that you identified. Otherwise, the whole exchange fails. So when most people call and say, Kyle, I've heard about this identification thing. How many properties can I identify? Well, it depends on what you want to do. But generally, you can identify up to three. If you want to actually buy more than three properties, there's other rules that will work.
Okay, that's really important. So now the million-dollar question I think I always get. Hey, Ryan, I own raw land. Actually, let me do one a little bit simpler. I own a rental house and I want to 1031 exchange that and buy raw land. Is that considered like kind?
Yeah, absolutely, because they're both held for investment purposes. Land is always investment.
Okay. What if I want to sell a self-storage, but buy a multifamily apartment building?
Absolutely. Yep. Also, like,
okay.
And this is one of the more common questions I get. Kyle, I've done a little research. This like-kind thing confuses me. How can I buy a rental if I'm selling self-storage? Because they don't seem like-kind. They're both investment properties. And you can really get off into the weeds. Water rights, cell phone towers, air rights, 30-year leases. If you want to buy a 30-year ground lease for a Taco Bell, that's technically treated as fee simple. 24, 10-30.
And is like-kind.
Interesting. Like-kind, yeah. So if you have questions, if you have something obscure, mineral rights or something obscure, we run across those all the time. Give me a call. I'm more than happy to tell you. Yes, this is like a big thing in the Seattle area up here that is also in some of the coastal areas or houses. Not
oh, interesting.
Even if you rent them out, they're not taxed as real property. It's the slip itself. So if you own like a boat slip, for example, that's taxed as real property. That's a change. So exchanging a houseboat is no different than dropping an RV on a piece of land. It's not real property.
Interesting. The slip itself. Okay. There's a lot of houseboats here. The ones that you see that are like really well designed that are affixed to the dock, still a houseboat?
It depends on how they're taxed. If they're taxed as real property, technically they would be exchanged. It all depends on how they're
gotcha.
Taxed.
Okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Personal use properties don't, because there's no long-term intent, which is what the IRS has said, is it's due a 1031. You need to hold with long-term intent for business or investment use, which also eliminates flips.
Yep.
So flippers out there, if any of you flip properties, nothing wrong with it. A lot of great flippers out there that do really well, but you can't do a 1031 exchange because there's no long-term intent to hold with business or investment use. Your goal is to fix it up, sell it as quickly as possible. So what we would tell flippers when they're like, Mr. and Mrs. Flipper call, and they're like, Kyle, can we do a 1031? I would say slow down.
Yeah.
Instead of buying, fix up, and selling, buy, fix up, and hold. Put some tenants in. Change the direction, change your trajectory, if you will, of what you're doing. Just slow down.
That's a great point. And what about property that is like short-term rentals, like Airbnbs or?
Absolutely. Ton of 1031s, especially since COVID. People sell in Seattle, buy in Arizona. They're buying a rental in Scottsdale, turn it into an Airbnb. A lot of people have done really well with that. Obviously, the market's changing in places like that, Palm Springs and stuff. But absolutely, Airbnb, VRBO. As long as there's not personal use more than a couple weeks a year and you're reporting rental income and everything as you should be, absolutely exchange.
So let's get to the really cool thing about 1031 exchange and really estate and long-term planning. So my understanding is that you buy a rent, let's say you're young and you're 21, you're 25, whatever, and you buy a rental property and it appreciates in value and you sell it and you buy three more. Like we talked about, we do go through the identification, we close it within 180 days of your settlement date. And you defer the gain and you buy three properties and then you roll that into an apartment complex and you 1031 out of those three properties and buy apartment complex. And you're doing the monopoly thing, right? Where you're going around the board, you're buying the cards and putting houses on and apartments on and all this. And you get to 85 years old or 90 years old or hopefully live longer, but then you pass away. And you're still holding the property when you die. Let's take a step back and be a little bit more positive here. Will I ever have to pay? How will I pay taxes if I eventually don't do a 1031? So let's say I do the one rental, I do the three, I do the apartment, and then I say, you know what? I'm not doing a 1031 this time. I'm just cashing out. What happens to my taxable liability at that point?
Very good question. So at that point, your taxes basically, your tax liability carries forward with you. So yeah, you would owe applicable taxes if you deferred the 1031 exchange in that scenario. However, what investors generally gravitate towards is this idea called swap until you drop. Because right now at the federal level, you can pass on $12.5 million or so federally taxed as part of your estate per spouse, which is awesome. That is
so $24 great. Million if you're married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Washington state has its own estate tax and other states have estate taxes too. But at the federal level, yeah, about $24, $25 million between two spouses can go to their heirs tax-free, which is awesome. So the idea that people start a piece of land or a rental or something, and then eventually they own Park Place.
Right.
And then once they pass, that goes to the heirs tax-free. Taxes die with them. So that's how the investors came up with the idea, swap until you drop, is that you're always going to be deferring taxes. But let's just say that there's a pilot out there that doesn't want to do this, that likes real estate now, but says, hey, I want to retire at 60. I want to travel the world. I don't want to manage real estate. Why would I do a 1031 now? Why wouldn't I just pay my taxes? because you keep more money working for you longer. That's the whole point of 1031, is that when you're using all the equity, not just the after-tax equity to invest, say that you sell that rental for $800,000 and you have a 25% tax. Instead of only being able to reinvest $600,000, you reinvest that full $800,000. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So if you look at two different choices here, your $600,000 and you reinvest that at a 75% LTV buys you $2.4 million in new property. That $800,000 that you deferred in the 1031 exchange, you're going to buy $3.2 million of new property.
Tax-free.
Just by doing the 1031 exchange. So $800,000 difference, the income on that might be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000
a year. Yeah.
Just because you did a 1031 exchange.
Yep. And think about it. So let's go back in time, right? Let's say you buy a rental property for $100,000. You exchange that up to a $500,000 three-pack. You exchange that up to a $1 million apartment. And eventually you get it all the way up to $10 million. You're like, the risk here, in for those that are not continuing to do the swap until you drop, was that what it called? Yeah, until you die or whatever it is. When you sell that $10 million apartment building, eventually they're going to go all the way back to what your original basis was on that first single family house as a way to concoct how much taxes you pay. So like all that deferral over the years was good because it kept your money working, but now it's time to pay the piper, right?
Yeah. And it's tough for us to say, if someone says, oh yeah, I don't ever want to pay taxes. I will never tell anyone that this is a tax regime.
Correct.
You're theoretically just deferring taxes. However, when they're working with their CPA, which we encourage all investors out there, even if you're not doing a 1031, you should all have a good CPA. Work with a CPA, figure out some estate planning, figure out what you want to do long-term, because yeah, you may want to cash out, like the example you just mentioned, Ryan, and it may not make sense, but oftentimes.
Speaking of CPA, so let's just talk about really quick, if you're going to do this, who do I need to go get? Who are my players on my team? You mentioned a CPA, and you're a company that provides qualified intermediary services. Is there anybody else I need to get on? So you need that's called a QI.
Yep, QI. And you may also hear like exchange facilitator, exchange accommodator, 1031 company, kind of broad definition. But yeah, we're the intermediary that will hold funds for the duration. CPA is important because we are a legally disinterested party. That means that we cannot guide the clients on any sort of tax issues, any sort of legal issues. It's up to them to find their own CPA and attorney to do that, which is why we encourage clients to seek professional counsel when it comes to your 1031 exchange. Because there's stuff I can talk about all day. 45 days to identify, 180 days to close. But like much of the tax code, section code 1031 contains a lot of.
Yep.
So if they're like, if a client calls and says, what does long-term intent exactly mean? There's not a definition. So that's why it's important for CPA to come up with a definition that fits.
That makes sense. Okay. So let's talk about time of death. Let's say I'm that guy. I buy one, I buy three, I buy an apartment, then I buy that $10 million property. And God forbid I pass away. And I have a trust because I planned correctly and the property then goes to my heirs. And my heirs get the property and they say, I loved what dad did, but I want nothing to do with this building and we're going to sell it immediately. What taxes do they pay?
Dad bought a property decades ago for $30,000. Now he's got $10 million of real estate. The heirs inherit that real estate. Basically, the taxes would have died swap until you drop it. So at that point, the heirs all get the step up in cost basis. And the day that dad died, whatever the value of the real estate was that day, that's basically what you paid for. So if it's worth $10 million, it's as if you had bought that property for $10 million that day, not the original $50,000 or whatever dad paid for it, that $10 million.
That's incredible. So it's an incredible way to defer your taxes all through life, build up a real estate empire, and then literally hand it off to your heirs tax-free. That's amazing. They say they value it at the time of death. Is that like an appraiser that goes out as part of the estate? What happens there?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people get broker's opinion of values. So work with your local broker that you work with on primary, for example, but they'll be able to tell you based on comps and stuff, here's an approximate value the day dad died. And your CPA will probably sign off on that and say yes.
Interesting. So people actually use just a broker opinion, not like a certified appraiser.
Yeah, they definitely can use an appraiser. I've heard of a lot of
yes.
They'll just get a broker's opinion of value based on comps in the area.
Wow. Okay.
You.
That's really great. Let's talk about the 1031 exchange client. They're under a short time clock, right? And so they can really feel the pressure of having to close on something, right? And I'm just going to be fully transparent here. I love it when 1031 exchange buyers are buying my property because I feel like I have them held over a barrel a little bit because they are under the gun to close or blow their transaction. Talk about some strategies to, in piloting, we call it increasing your team and also time, no time, right? When we get into the air, like what we want to do is we want to create time. We want to decide if we have no time bucket or lots of time, right? And so sometimes we need to slow things down. So we assess the situation and say, hey, are we on fire? Do we need it on the ground right now? Or how do we build more time into running checklists and going through an emergency procedure? We think about that way. So if you're like, hey, I want to sell my property and 1031 exchange, like you said, I want to be under contract, like even before I close on something, right? So how can they build more time?
So you really can't. The only time you can get an extension is for a federally declared disaster that basically directly affects the exchange. Like their property was in the disaster area, the other party in the transaction died, something crazy. So we tell people there are essentially no extensions. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan, because that 45 day ID period is a killer. Like any market in this country right now, Peachtree City, Gig Harbor, wherever you're at, the market moves quickly. So that 45 days is like some crazy time warp where it's like the equivalent of a passenger flying out of Vegas in a lot of chop. In the summer, it's shaky. You don't know what's going on. You're like, you're scrambling to find something, do whatever you can. And so that 45 day thing is just a killer. So what a lot of people do is that they'll look for something like DSTs, for example, maybe a backup.
We'll dive into that in a second. Yeah.
But have a backup, have something like that that was going to be open, because a lot of times they make great first options, but a minimum, have a backup there. Because even if you're under contract on that rental that you love, things happen all the time.
Yeah. What interesting. I heard one tip that I thought was really helpful and impactful. And, you know, if you are selling your property and you plan to 1031 exchange into something else, this is going to sound contradictory, non-intuitive, right? Normally, when you're trying to sell the property, you're trying to get the buyer to sell it to buy it as fast as possible. But you actually take like the reverse approach where you actually, when someone is trying to buy your property, you actually write in contract extensions. So if you get too close to your closing period, you as the seller have the right to extend the closing timeline out, giving you more time to find replacement property before you even sell your property, right? I always say, try to get from your buyer 3 30-day extensions. So it gives you the right to just continue building that time so you don't feel pressured in finding something, right? And also maybe even put in a clause where you can kill the deal and walk away if you even get to the end of your contract and you can't find replacement property, right? Now that might give some concern to the buyer because they're spending money on due diligence and time on your transaction. But hey, life's what you can negotiate. So whatever you can work out with your buyer to give yourself the flexibility to really expand that clock. Let's talk about the strategy of buying property before you do a 1031 exchange. I believe that's called the reverse 1031 exchange. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, reverse exchange, super popular right now. But really what I would say, Ryan, it's a different type of 1031. Because in the normal 1031, you sign into the contract, we take title, we hold funds, and then deliver those funds. In a reverse exchange, when you close on the purchase first, we actually have to take title to that property, which means that you can't get a traditional loan, like a conforming loan. You have to have cash. And if you don't have cash, hard money, which can be super expensive. And not to mention the costs, a normal 1031, well under $1,000. We charge $795 to do with loans. Reverse exchange is being 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times that, 9 times that, pound cost, commercial, residential. So reverse exchange, much more expensive than a traditional exchange. But if you need to close on a purchase first and you have cash, there's a way to.
That's incredible. So yeah, think about that strategy too, where if you've bought a property in 2024 already, could you still use that as, assuming you bought cash, let's say I bought a rental property and I'm selling a property, could I still do reverse 1031 even though I've already bought that property?
Good question. You cannot retroactively do a 1031 exchange. Ideally, once you're under contract, whether it's a reverse exchange or a normal exchange, we should be working on setting up the exchange right now. With a reverse exchange, we file an LLC with the state, and that LLC will take title to the property. So there's more complications, more work that goes into it, but it's not something you can let.
It's interesting. You mentioned the state, and that made me think of, is there any differences state by state for 1031 exchanges, or is it at the federal level?
So it really is at the federal level. That being said, there are some intricacies state by state. Whether you're in Tennessee or Oregon or wherever you're at out there, this is why it's important to work with the CPA. Because like in California, for example, like if you've owned a rental in California and say exchanged up into Seattle, which a lot of people have done, you basically have to report to the state of California every year, did you sell that property? Because they're going to claw back their taxes. Washington doesn't do that yet. But yeah, states have clawbacks. Most states, you defer all the state taxes. Washington state, you pay the real estate excise tax. You don't defer.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah, which is expensive. Yeah. A graduated tax up to 3%. So,
yep, absolutely.
That could be very expensive.
So, yeah, so there's some intricacies. Overall, it's a federal tax.
Interesting. So, let's talk about other options for buying real property. I like to joke. So sometimes pilots become accidental real estate investors. So throughout their career, maybe they live around a military base. They get a collection of these single family homes. They get close to retirement. And now they have 15, 20 single family homes in random places all over the country. And not places that you really like to visit or vacation, right, necessarily. And they become a drag, even managing a property manager, maybe things like that. But they want to get out of it. But they like real estate and they want to still be in real estate. So they want a 1031 exchange into something. They don't want to pay the tax, right? But they want to free themselves of this burden of rental properties, right?
Terrible.
Terrible.
Termites, trash.
Toilets.
Tenants, toilets. Yeah. I heard someone said rotten R's recently, which is renters, rodents, and relatives.
Nice. I love it.
Same principle. But yeah, they want to get out of that active management and go into something more passive.
Yeah. And we get calls like this all the time at Spartan where it's like, people call in, they're like, yeah, I'm just a tired landlord. I'm done with these rental properties and I don't want to manage it anymore. But I bought them for a really good price and now I have this massive gain and I don't want to pay the tax either. So I'm caught between not wanting to pay the taxes, but also wanting to get out of this active real estate management. So they look for properties to buy and they don't want to buy more real estate that's going to cause them more active management. So what are some things people can do to still satisfy their exchange?
Yeah. So Delaware statutory trusts are extremely popular in best for a multitude of reasons. One being the ease of actually owning this. When clients find out, you're telling me that I can go passive and collect income from self-storage and I don't have to make any decisions. I just collect a check. Are you kidding me? Sounds too good to be true, but it's really not. It's one of those things where it's not too good to be true. People just don't know about it. They could buy triple net lease properties. There's a lot of options for investors who love real estate, who've made money in real estate, don't want to pay the taxes, want to do a 1031, defer the taxes into something that's 100% passive. They don't have to think about it. It's mailbox money in the real estate.
Yeah. So let's pick apart both of those things separately. Let's start with DSTs. So Delaware Statutory Trust sounds like a lot of legal paperwork that somebody did in a fancy name. We don't have to get into the history of DSTs. But let's zoom out a little bit, 30,000 foot view of what a DST is, like how do you find them? What are they? What does that really mean to the investor?
Yeah, Delaware Statutory Trust, really not that complicated, actually. But DSTs are fractional interest and generally commercial properties. It could be a single property, like an Amazon warehouse. It could be a portfolio of self-storage, for example. But you're really just a trustee to manage the property and everything, and you just collect. You still get the tax benefit of depreciation, which would be the number one reason you'd own investment real estate, and you're going to collect income. It truly is mailbox money for real estate because you're going to check your mailbox generally once a month, just get a check. It's almost too good to be true.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. What are some of the downsides of DSTs?
So liquidity, that seems to be the big one. I think most DST sponsors would tell you, well, we're going to look for a 4 to 6, maybe 7, 8 year hold. It's not going to be something that you're going to get out of it. This is a long-term hold. So if you want to sell, there could be barriers to sell. Like you need to sell in 2 years, you're like, real estate's in a downturn, I want to get out. You're probably not going to be able to get out. And if you do, it would probably be at a distance.
Yeah, the analogy, and also another thing to think about, I think the downsides aside, I kind of view DSTs like the comparison to flying is this. If you want to be an active real estate investor, it's like going to rent an airport on the weekend and pulling out your own airplane, doing your own flight planning, stressing about your own weather and managing that airplane. Doing a DST is like booking a ticket on Delta, and where you have a professional flight crew, you sit in the back, you enjoy faster ground speed and more buttoned up crews than maybe just a one-man band flying a solo plane. Yeah, you're not in the jump seat, right? You're in the back of enjoying your retirement, enjoying the caviar or whatever they're serving that day. I don't think they serve caviar, whatever it might be, right, on the plane. And how would somebody go about finding a DST to invest in? Like, where does that marketplace exist?
You have to work with a specific type of financial advisor that handles DSTs because they're technically securities. Even though it is real property that you own, you do have to work with a specific type of financial advisor that actually does DSTs. And there's, I would say the majority don't handle DSTs. Yeah. They're not approved on their platform. Financial advisor doesn't know about them, whatever the case is. But there's a few specialty firms, more than a few, but there are some specialty firms that focus on DSTs. And it's important to know who you're working with on, just like 1031s, it's important to know who you're working with on DSTs, because I know within the DST world, I haven't heard any horror stories of DSTs. Like almost all stories have been really good and positive DSTs, but some have been better than others. So that's why it's important to know who you...
Let's talk about the triple net option you said. So you said something that's really passive that you can 1031 into is a triple net. For the listeners, really quick, triple net is a...
Basically, if you own a Starbucks, that would be, or like a Walgreens, Amazon warehouse would be a good example of a triple net property. Basically, you own the building and the real estate, but that's it. Amazon or Starbucks or Walgreens, whoever is responsible for all the taxes, improvements being made, everything that goes in with that property. So you just own it really in name only, and you're just collecting a check every month, which can be good because if your tenant is Amazon, for example, they're going to pay their rent every month. That you may have a 10-year lease or 20-year lease, and you know that as long as you hold this building, Amazon's going to be paying their rent. Again, there's a lot of risks associated with it. I don't want to make it sound like anything's guaranteed or this is financial advice. Obviously, talk to a financial advisor and a CPA. But within the triple net space, basically the tenant is responsible for it.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to cover and just jump back, but we're going to dive into one more detail on this before we ask our takeaway question today. When, let's just say that first rental property I buy has $50,000 of cash to buy it, and I use $50,000 of debt to buy it. Talk to me about the replacement debt requirement in a 1031 exchange and the nuances there.
Yeah. So this is another more common question I get, and a very confusing question, probably the most confusing question for clients is, they say, oh, I've been doing research on 1031s. I've read about this debt replacement thing. What? Now I'm confused. What does that mean? It means that the debt needs to be replaced in the new property. So if you had a $300,000 loan that was paid off at closing of your sale, it means you're going to have to get new debt for at least $300,000. What does that mean in layman's terms? Because if you're like me, you're trying to think of what that means exactly. Basically, you want to do two things in a 1031 exchange: buy for equal or greater value and reinvest your proceeds. So if you sell for $700,000 and have $400,000 in proceeds come in after the loan's paid off.
And is it all or nothing on the equity side? Do I have to find a replacement at or above? Or can I do I'm going to get hit with some tax, but...
Yeah, good question. That's called a partial exchange. Super common. And this happens all the time, especially with pilots. But you have this duplex you're selling for $750,000 and you've owned it forever. It's all equity. You want to take $100,000 out and pay off junior's college education. That's fine. You'll still defer the $650,000, what have you, that $100,000 you would pay tax. So don't ever think that it's going to blow up the whole exchange. But for those of you that don't want to pay any more tax than you have to, if you take money out, it will be taxed.
Yeah, makes sense. Now, last question. And I really appreciate you coming into the studio today, Kyle. One key takeaway that you have in regards to one piece of advice from today's conversation about people that are just getting started in real estate, one piece of kind of tax, in regards to the tax benefits, what would that one takeaway be for you?
Yeah, with investment real estate, I can't stress this enough. It's not directly related to 1031, but find a good CPA. Like, you would kill you, Ryan, if you knew how many people with $5, $10 million in real estate do taxes themselves. And maybe not even TurboTax. They're just freehanding it. A CPA, a good CPA, is worth their
weight. I agree.
I could give advice to anyone on this call, 1031 or not, work with a good CPA. It's not to say that doing there's nothing wrong with TurboTax and stuff. There's stuff that you or I, even though we've been doing this, we would still miss. People out there miss. That's the CPA's job.
Great, great advice. Kyle, really appreciate you coming on to the show. You're now part of the show alumni. So we will call on you if listeners have questions. And speaking of which, I wanted to highlight that if you're listening to the show and you have a question, you can go to passiveincomepilots.com/question and you can ask a question and we will air it on the show or not. If you don't want to, that's okay. We can just ask it for you. And we'll bring in Kyle to get some great guidance and wisdom on that on a future show. So Kyle, there's a lot of options when it comes to picking a 1031 exchange company. Why should I go to Velocity 1031?
Yeah, it's a great question. Not all 1031 companies are created. We're super responsive. That's really where I hang my hat. And I'll leave you my contact information later in the show. But I really enjoy outreach with clients, meeting with clients, talking to clients about their 1031 questions. Us as a company, we're insured. But most importantly, what we do is that when funds close after your sale, they go directly into a trust account we set up on your behalf. So unlike many other firms, we don't commingle our funds.
No, that's a really important distinction because you mentioned earlier that people can get in touch with you. And I think that's a huge service where there's a no obligation to ask you a question. So like you've made yourself very available to talk to clients and ensure that they can get in touch with you regarding their transaction, which I think is like a fantastic service. Like it's no obligation if you have a question, even if you don't go forward with it, people can reach out to you, which I think is great. Let's talk about the insurance really quick, because I think this is something that doesn't really get talked about very much. So when you use like Velocity 1031, you guys back the transaction with an insurance policy.
Absolutely. There's errors and omissions if we were to make a mistake, fidelity bond if something happened to the company. But what's really cool is that we send funds directly from escrow into their trust. And so when clients are like, how do I know that? Your trust account number that we set up and you can verify will be on the settlement.
Yeah.
So we're not going to tell you, hey, your funds are going into a trust account and they're commingled with everyone else's funds. They're actually on the settlement statement. That's how we verify and that's how we prove to you these funds are going directly from escrow into your trust account and never to us, into a general account or a sweep account that we hold.
Yeah, and I'll tell you personally, like you guys, your clients have worked with us many times, and I know that working with Velocity 1031 has been absolutely seamless. And so I can speak from firsthand experience that you guys are really a buttoned up shop, and I've met your founder
Dean,
and he's been into the office. And so I'm just very comfortable with working with you guys. So thank you for that.
Another thing we do that's really cool is that we have a portal where clients can view their accounts 24/7, unprecedented in the 1031
industry. Yeah, totally.
The 1031 industry, by and large, is very archaic, and some of you may know this. So what we've really done is just turn the industry on its head and make sure that everything is client-focused. You have a portal, funds are safe at all time, commingled, just little things that you would think are common sense in the industry.
But before we wrap things up, I wanted to ask, Kyle, how do listeners get in touch with you, learn more about your company? So if they're thinking about a 1031 exchange, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So my direct contact information, anyone on this call is free to call, text, email me anytime, especially if you just have general questions. If there's something that I didn't get to on the show, something you want to ask further, give me a call or shoot me an email. My direct line is 425-247-3307. And my email is very simple. It's just kyle@velocity1031.com.
Oh, you're brave leaving your number on the show. I like it. Kyle, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Until then, we'll see you on the next episode.